the Redskins. Hail victory! Praise on the warpath. Fight for all we see.
Green driven back to midfield on the far side. He's got the ball up to the 45, far side 40. A seam to the 35, vaults a man to the 30. Breaks to the near side 25. Watch out to the 20. Near side 10. He's gone. Touchdown, Washington Redskins.
This is Burgundy and Gold Flashback. Now, here's Mike Richmond.
You are listening to Burgundy and Gold Flashback, where the tradition of a storied NFL franchise, the Washington Redskins, stays alive. I'm Mike Richmond, author of the Redskins Encyclopedia and the Washington Redskins Football Vault. My website is redskinshistorian.com. That's redskinshistorian.com. My guest is one of the most versatile offensive linemen in Redskins history. He played guard, center, and tackle in his 10 seasons in D.C., from 1966 to 1975, starting or substituting wherever needed. He also was key to the 1972 Redskins squad that went 11-3 and played in Super Bowl VII. Adaptability was his middle name. Ray Shunke, thanks for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure, Mike.
Great to have you. First, I want to offer my congratulations. I heard you were selected for induction to the Polynesian Football Hall of Fame. You will be inducted among six candidates in the class of 2015.
Thank you very much. It was a surprise, and I'm humbled and honored because even though when I was playing, there were very few Polynesians, and of course, there are many now who are outstanding athletes and great ball players, and to be selected as part of that group, I feel very honored.
Mm-hmm. I should say you're a native of Hawaii, so great honor, very nice. Later, I want to talk to you about your career as well as why you've come out strongly in support of the Redskins name amid the ongoing debate. But first, let's touch on the current scenario with the Redskins, and it is bleak. They're 1-5 as we speak, with the 2-4 Tennessee Titans coming up on Sunday. They're on a four-game losing streak, most recently losing 27-20 to the Cardinals. Now, they've lost 13 of their past 14 games, going back to the eight-game losing streak from last season. Just to put things in perspective, we're inching closer to the most wrenching period in team history. The Redskins went winless in 23 straight games over the 1960 through 61 seasons. So let me ask you, Ray, as a proud Redskins alumnus who played in one of the most successful periods in team history under George Allen in the 70s, what goes through your mind when seeing all of this unfold?
Well, you know, it's disheartening, but, you know, I've had high hopes, particularly with the new transition of Gruden and the players, and they appear to have everything. And even when RG got hurt, I felt that Cousins would be well-suited for the offense and would do an excellent job. And, of course, as the season played out, it became obvious that they were having problems. But it's not over with yet, you know, and I don't want to, you know, be thinking of that, you know, that they're going to come back and make the playoffs. But it has happened before. You know, teams can get together. It's a new team, new coach. They're going to be tested. This is the biggest test that they all have. The head coach has got to come up with a winning formula. The players have got to step forward. Leaders have got to come forward more than ever before. And it can happen. You know, I think it's a very good team. I think Cousins is a very good quarterback, but it's just little bitty things, you know, and that's the difference between winning and losing in the NFL. Any team can beat any team on any given Sunday.
Well,
so I'm still optimistic. They got a long way to go, but it has happened, and I think if with Gruden and if everybody comes together, it could happen.
Right. Well, I did want to ask you about the fact that Gruden is a first year coach, and what were we to expect out of these Redskins with a coach, a rookie head coach in the NFL? He had proven himself elsewhere in the Arena Football League, but just stepping foot for the first time in the big league. So were we expecting them to make the playoffs this year?
The world I come from, Mike, is that there's only one standard. That's winning. That's what the NFL is all about. I don't care if you're the first year, the second year, the third year. You got to win. There's no excuse. That's it. You mean it's George Allen said, gentlemen, I'm sorry to tell you, there's only one standard here. We win, they lose. That's it. And you've got to come to terms with that. And if you lose, people lose their jobs. And it's a terrible business. I mean, first of all, if you run into telephone poles is enough, but then you have to win on top of that. And it's the hardest thing. And for a coach, it's endless. I mean, there's just so many things they have to worry about. It's takes everything you have to get there. And I wish them the best, you know, but they have to, you know, Cousins got to win in that fourth quarter. You know, I don't care, you know, you can't, there's no excuses. Gruden's got to come up with a formula. He's got to get his team together. The defense has got to hold. The line has got to do their job. So while I'm still very supportive and still very eager for them to get there, they have a big hurdle here. You know, and can they make it happen? And I'm hoping they can.
You mentioned George Allen and the fact that he said, gentlemen, there's only one thing we need to be concerned about. You know, it's winning. Do you think that there's a problem with the culture on the Redskins right now? Let me just read this quote to you by Brian Arakpo after the 27-17 loss to Seattle. He says, quote, we went toe-to-toe with the defending Super Bowl champions. Like, if you read into that a little bit, it sounds like he's a little bit content with that loss. So is there a feeling that they're accepting losing at this point?
Well, you know, you can read it the other way, too. Hey, look, you know, they're the Super Bowl champions. They won, but, man, you know, I made that guy in front of me, you know, pay for everything. I've been on losing teams, you know, with the Washington Redskins. I played without a game for 3 years, although we were the number one offense for two of those years. We still had losing teams. And I know, you know, we played the Cowboys twice a year, and we beat them down there every time, you know, and they went on to win the league, the division, you know. So, and you feel great, you know. You feel great, but at the same time, you know, you're losing, so you know you have this mixed blessing. You know, I did well, but the team lost, and it's a culture that has to be overcome, and from a player standpoint. Part of that is on Arakpo, and particularly because he is such a great player and because he's looked upon to be a leader. There's different ways to do it. One is you can say, you know, hey, we did well and I'm proud, but we're going to do better. The other way, you know, guys get crazy. They get mad. You know, they start cussing at people, you know. And it's every team has a different culture. Some are quiet. Some are boastful. I played for winners, and Allen was a master of getting each division within the team, the special teams, defense, and offense. And what I used to be amazed at during the game, when things would go haywire, which they usually always did, somebody had to step forward. It was either the special teams or the offense or the defense, but somebody had to step forward to get the momentum back. And it always happened, you know, I'm going to say 75% of the time. And that was what was so unique about it. You know, if one division was hurting, somebody else would jump to the forefront. And everybody thought that way. Everybody was thinking, how do we get this game back, you know?
When you say George Allen and special teams, he's the man who wrote the book on special teams. So tell me, I'm not sure if you played on any special teams units, maybe what field goals.
Well, I did when I was younger, not with the Skins. I played on this field goal team. That was about it. But I didn't run down on kickoffs or punt returns, but I did that when I was my first couple of years.
Right. But given that he counted on special teams for one or two big plays a game, thinking that those plays would possibly alter the course of the game, what could be wrong with the Redskins special teams in recent years? How come those units are coming up so short?
You know, I'm not there. I can only say that the special teams I played with, for the George Allen teams, they viewed themselves as equal to the offense and defense, and they were treated that way. They were highly respected, and these were kamikaze guys. I mean, they were willing to sacrifice their bodies, and they would throw themselves at the wedges. I mean, it was crazy what these guys were. They were young, fearless men who are just so dedicated to their specialties, and prized and respected. And that's the way that Allen treated. Actually, it was special teams. Actually, defense was first, special teams was second, and offense was last. Because he's always fearful that we would fumble the ball or get an interception, and you know everybody else he could control. But it was just a great feeling that everybody was equal. You know, everybody had a role to play.
Right. I know some of the guys you're referring to are like Rusty Tillman, Bill Malachek. They just gave it their all.
Eric Malachek,
John Tillman.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember all the guys who were.
Mike Hall.
They just were Brad Dusick. I mean, they were just killers. I mean, just killers. And, you know, and when we would. I always got there early because I got taped up a lot, and these guys could barely crawl up on the table. You know, after you know midway in the season, they were so banged up. But boy, I tell you, when they rang the bell, off they would go.
Right. Well, very very interesting. We can only hope that the Redskins special team units of today can take on that same fearless type attitude. When we come back from break, I want to talk to you more about your career as an offensive lineman. Here's This Week in Redskins History.
Hey, it's Mike Richmond, the official Redskins historian and author of the Washington Redskins Football Vault and the Redskins Encyclopedia. From the pages of my books comes This Week in Redskins History. The 1987 season was interrupted by a player strike that led NFL owners to create replacement teams, consisting mostly of NFL rejects and unsigned rookies. The Redskins went 3-0 in the replacement series, capping it on October 19, 1987, with a 13-7 win over a Cowboys squad featuring some regulars who crossed the picket line, including future Hall of Famers Tony Dorsett and Randy White. That day, the Scabskins relied on such no-names as quarterback Tony Robinson, who was on a work furlough from prison, to record one of the top upsets in Redskins history. With their regulars back, the Skins rolled through the rest of the season and captured Super Bowl XXII. For more on Redskins history, check out my website at RedskinsHistorian.com. That's RedskinsHistorian.com. I'm Mike Richmond for This Week in Redskins History.
Welcome back to Burgundy and Gold Flashback. I'm Redskins historian Mike Richmond, back with Ray Shunke, one of the most versatile offensive linemen to ever wear the burgundy and gold. Ray, thanks again for coming on the show.
It's really, my pleasure, Mike.
Really appreciate it. You played your college ball at Southern Methodist. You were very versatile there as well. Fullback, guard, tackle, center, linebacker were your positions. You won all-conference, all-American honors. Then you were drafted by the Dallas Cowboys in 1963. You played 2 years there, and you were cut. You said at one point after you were cut that you were very frustrated, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. Were you near quitting football at that point?
Well, it wasn't near quitting. I was frustrated. I didn't gel well with the line coach. I was a starting lineman, but we didn't mix well, and I didn't appreciate the fact that I was a starter. And because I didn't particularly like my coach, I asked Landry if I could move to defense. I was really a defensive player in college, and in which I'm sure Tom Landry was a brilliant coach. I never felt that they would go on because they had so much tension on the team between the blacks and the whites. A lot of the white players were from the SEC conference, which was integrated at the time, but they drafted a lot of and signed a lot of black players from the black colleges from the South. So he had this, you know, tinderbox that was just ready to explode. But he was so brilliant, and if you didn't go along with the program, they'd kick you out and put somebody else in, you know, and thought nothing of who you were or what you were. I mean, he'd turn to Gil Brandt and say, give me a running back. I mean, this, you know, they had Dwayne Thomas, who I thought was one of the greatest running backs ever, and they got rid of him. They got Calvin Hill. Calvin Hill, Grayson came one moment. They got rid of him. They got Dorsett, you know, and they just, you know, it didn't matter. But anyway, they got rid of me, and I thought somebody would pick me up. I got injured, and I wanted to get out of there, so I just assumed somebody picked me. Nobody did, and I was really, really down. But that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Matter of fact, I saw Landry when he was still alive up here. He's at a golf club, and I was out there playing golf, and somebody told me he was on one of the greens. So I ran up to him and said, "You cut me." And I figured he said, "Well, that's just I'm really shocking. You cut me." He figured that, "Whoa, are you going to punch me?" And I said, and I shook his hand. I said, "This is the best thing ever happened to me in my life. And I want to thank you."
What was it? And what was his reaction?
Well, he didn't know what to say. but what happened out of that is that I learned several things. One, I was lucky to get back into the game. And I was strong enough to demand certain things when I came and actually came into Green Bay, which was the number one franchise, traded to Cleveland. They cut me based on Landry badmouthing me for a player that they chose. Supposed to go back to Green Bay and get my money. I said, there's no way in 66 that that was going to happen. And luckily, I told my wife, give me a week. I've made some phone calls. And the Skins gave me a tryout, and I was starting within four games, and I played 10 years.
Right, and actually your first season with the Redskins, 1966, was the first year of Coach Otto Graham, who you referred to earlier. Now, with the Redskins, I know you continued rotating positions through the end of your career in 1975, but guard was your primary position, right?
Guard was my primary position, but because I had been so versatile in college, it didn't bother me. And so when I came, I mean, I think the team knew, and I was always, you know, a backup to everybody. And then when the injuries came, they would move very quickly. And it became a strength of mine, particularly as the coaching changes and the teams became more intense, particularly with Lombardi and with Allen, the demands on me became enormous because I had to learn everybody's position and learn all the defenses and plays. And when somebody got hurt in the middle of the game, I had to switch and there was to be no excuses. You know, I can't say, "Hey, wait a minute, you know, I forgot what side I was on," you know, and it wasn't that way. You had to be perfect. And I was lucky that I could play in some very important games at different positions that were, which made, I could participate in some really great victories.
Well, I want to say that some of those great victories were the two playoff games in 1972, the Redskins beating the Packers in the opening round of the playoffs that year. You subbed for John Wilbur at guard. He had a kidney injury. He was out that game. And then in the NFC Championship game, the 26-3 win over the Cowboys, you subbed for Terry Hermeling at guard for most of that
tackle.
Game.
Left tackle, right.
And actually that paints a great picture of your versatility, one game at guard, and then the next game at tackle. So I did want to point that out. Now, I did mention earlier the Redskins name debate. You're one of several ex-Redskins who openly supports the team's name amid the controversy. Some of the others are Gary Clark, Mark Mosley, Chris Cooley, Roy Jefferson, and as we noted before, of course, you're of Polynesian descent. Why have you come out in support of the name?
Well, you know, in my tenure with the team, as well as in my association with the team, I've never felt that the Redskins was a slur, demeaning, derogatory in any sense of the way. And if I felt at the time, if it were, and it, you know, if it in any way was related to the N-word, you know, I would have stood up and say, "Hey, this is wrong," and because I was a social activist, you know, I was a player. I was very involved in politics. That was one of my avocations. I loved it, and I was against the Vietnam War, you know, in the '60s, and I wasn't afraid to say that. I wasn't against wars. I was just against that war. And when Nixon came out to practice, I criticized him. The reporters knew I'd do that, and I did it. And my coaches just went crazy and said, "How dare you? This is the President of the United States. You know, you got to have more respect." And I said, "Well, there's a war going on," And they nearly got, you know, Allen was just furious at me, although over time, they kept me in overtime, as you indicated. You know, I really came home back that really helped him, and he and I became so incredibly close out of that whole episode. But I wasn't afraid to say something. And so when I started looking at this and being Polynesian and being aware of the issues of Polynesians in Hawaii, and some of the problems that they had, which are similar to Native American Indians, I became very sympathetic and understood some of the issues, particularly the economic, social, and health and educational problems that exist on reservations. And to me, there was a great opportunity here for Snyder and the other NFL owners who are very invested in the name to really turn around and become wonderful helpers and really saints to step in and really make a difference in the Indian lives. And so I saw this not as I said before, I never felt the name was bad, but here was a way to leverage this whole thing by the Indians. And so I became very vocal about it. I did an op-ed in Washington Post, and I've been on debates in which I've sparred with other journalists and audiences, you know, about this whole issue.
Including most recently at the University of Maryland, I know.
Yes, but if you look at the conditions on the reservations, in just about every aspect of health, education, housing, jobs, they're one of the worst. And so I see this as an opportunity for Dan Snyder and other owners to really make a difference, because they're invested in that name and they want that name. And I think that they really weren't aware of these conditions. Most people aren't aware of what goes on the reservations. However, the urban Indians, they really feel that the word is derogatory, and they feel very strongly about that. And so there is a disconnect between urban Indians and those on the reservations. And what I'm disappointed about is that many of the urban Indians are willing to throw the Indians on the reservation under the bus. And there's 4 million of them out there, you know, so I'm somewhat chagrined about this. But at the same time, I'm hoping that the name is retained, that Dan Snyder does work with and convinces the other owners, you know, to really do something about conditions on Indian reservations, and life is improved, and the name is retained.
So let me ask you, I've seen you quoted before saying that it appears to be more of a political move than something where people are generally interested in improving the lives of American Indians. So you think that there's a political motive behind this, those who are advocating for a change of name?
Well, there's a guy who really is one of the major people at the forefront, a guy by the name of Ray Hall Bettner, who is an Oneida leader, and a very interesting story. He was a steel worker and was able to put himself through Harvard, and then came and got 900 tribe people to come together and form a nation and got it approved by the federal government, and then turned around, went up, it was upstate New York, and then went to the state governor of New York and convinced them to give them tax exemption on taxes and set up a casino and became very wealthy and very powerful. And he has taken his money, and he has great influence in the Democratic Party in Washington, that he's been able to convince several senators and Harry Reid and the president, and Hillary Clinton. And these are all people that I support, and convince them that the name should be changed. And from that, it has mushroomed to the D.C. City Council, the PG Council, judges, reporters, political writers, sports writers, sports commentators, endless organizations, religious organizations. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And but what surprised me, after all that effort, the polls still say, you know, the majority of people don't want to change the name. And of course, then everybody starts talking about, well, the polls were wrong, you know, and that 30% is really not 30%. It's really 40% or 50%.
Well, you can really say that about any poll. Any poll
can
be.
So they, you know, everybody is trying to manipulate things. But what really disappoints me about the whole thing is that Ray Hallbender is a Native American Indian. He knows about these statistics on these reservations. He knows what it's like out there. And to say that, to just turn around and want to change the name, and he spends hundreds of thousands of dollars, not millions, and raises all this effort, and when he could be really making a difference. If I were him, I would have gone to the Washington Redskins and said, hey, look, conditions are really awful on the reservations. I'd gone to Goodell and said, you know, we need help. We need financial resources. And one of a major paper by Dr. Austin of the Policy Institute, stating he studied that whole area of Native reservation for Native American Indians, and in order to improve the circumstances of education and economics, they need a large infusion of financial resources, and that's the only way they're going to make it. They're not going to make it because you change the name. They're going to make it because they have to have financial help. And so I thought this, he could say, "Hey, look, I'm very successful. I want to partner with you." you know, and let's make a difference, you know, and let's show that, that you know, that name that you talked about, Redskins, it really is a good name. And let's show the world that, that you guys really care. So, you know, that's what I would have done. And I don't understand when I bring that up, everybody says, well, you know, the white man is buying off, or the billionaire is buying off the people. And I'm saying, so you're going to throw 4 million people under the bus? Or are you guys going to help them? And on all you journalists, are you going to do, you know, put your money where your mouth is? Well, you know, they move the arguments to a racial slur, and that's where they want to go. They don't want to be where I am, you know, so.
Well, they think it's bribery in terms of.
That's right. They think he's bribery, and I look at it differently. You know, if I didn't know about it, now I know about it, and I have a name that I think is really honorable, and I can do something. And if the Indians, see, again, the Indians on the reservation, they don't have a problem with the name Redskin. It's the Indians in the urban communities who have a problem. And so it's there's a disconnect there, and I can certainly sympathize with those who are in urban communities, and you know, and feel they're being persecuted or discriminated against, or their children, you know, are called Indians and made fun of because they're different. I understand that. I was Native American. I mean, I'm Native American. I'm Polynesian, but I'm brown skinned, and part of my former years were in the South in Texas, and I was a brown-skinned, fat, nice kid, and older kids. I was, I was the only brown-skinned in the school, and the older kids would come and beat up on me. They don't call me half-ass N-word, and take off my pants, you know. And this went on, and I finally realized I got to do something. You know, this is never going to end. You know, it's unfortunate, you know, that you have to fight through those kind of situations. And of course, I suddenly became a 6'4", 215, 13-year-old
right.
They started running away from. But, you know, it's unfortunate, but I understand those who feel that way. I happen to disagree with them. I am very interested in improving the welfare of Native American Indians on reservations. The statistics are just the worst of the worst. And I'm not willing to throw them under the bus.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with you that those issues on the Indian reservations should be addressed seriously. I think the Redskins are trying to do that. Dan Snyder has formed his organization, his internal foundation, to address that. So I applaud him for that. And I know the issues you're talking about, health concerns, education, unemployment, alcoholism, drug abuse, all of those issues need to be addressed. Well, I really love this conversation, Ray, and certainly appreciate it. I'm sure we'll cross paths at upcoming Redskins alumni events, and I'll look for you this Sunday at FedEx Field. I assume you're going to be there for Alumni Day?
I am. I actually have a suite there with a good friend of mine. We've had it for 18 years. His name is Tommy Boggs. He passed away 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago. He and I have been buddies, and we share a suite together. And so I'm usually there every game, and I usually come down on the field before the game just to check things out. And it has been a nice relationship. I mean, when they played at RFK, I had tons of tickets, but I couldn't go to games because it was too personal for me. I just, when the fans started booing, I couldn't deal with it. Mm-hmm. But now it's like being in my living room, but I'm there watching, and I'm still an X and O guy, and I'm always interested in the big chess game that goes on.
Well, thanks again, and I want to extend many thanks to my audience for listening to Burgundy and Gold Flashback, and thanks to my producer, Mike Engel, for his work running the board. I'm Mike Richman. My website is redskinshistorian.com. That's redskinshistorian.com. For now, hail to the Redskins.